they're going to do a slide show right here.
Started. We'll call this meeting to order. Get to my page here. We welcome everyone here to the inaugural meeting of the Governor's Early Childhood Commission. It's great to see so many of you. We welcome our commission members. Thanks for joining us. Welcome all of you who are here with us today. It's an honor to have you here in this space, working on this issue together. As all of you know, and this is why we're here, during the 2019 session, Senator Milner was very instrumental in passing HB 47, the Early Childhood Coordination Amendments Bill. And Representative Snow was also the other sponsor on the bill. And this Early Childhood Commission is designed really to bring us all together. That was the idea. We know we have so many people working in this space, and it is an incredible space. The hope was that if we were working more in concert together, and Anne will share more about her vision behind this, but I do feel strongly that we can better coordinate amongst our agencies, which is why you are all here as members, and I'm grateful to have you here as the head of these agencies that work in this space. I want to start by apologizing for canceling our last meeting. The vice president was in town. Not something that happens every day. In fact, it's the only day it's happened in the 6 years that I've been lieutenant governor. Also, when the vice president comes into town, we have no control over that schedule. We usually don't find out until just a few days before, and it was unfortunate that happened. Now, we could have had this meeting without me. I don't pretend to think I'm so important that you can't meet and move the work of the commission forward without me, but I will tell you this. I ask that we reschedule it because this is very important to me. I do sit on 35 boards and commissions, which is way too many, and I recognize that. It is the duty of the lieutenant governor, though, to serve on those. I will tell you that while I'm sure someone thought they were all important at the time, I do not think that they all are as important as some of them. And I want you to know that this is a commission that means a great deal to me. It's something I care passionately about. My wife got her degree in special education from Utah State with a dual emphasis in early childhood and severe. And when I practiced law many years ago, I actually represented several school districts in the state and worked on some of these issues with those school districts. And so I believe as I've looked at the all of the problems that we face as a society and as a state, and we look at, we talked today, we had a 3-hour meeting, an important meeting on mental health. Many of us, this is a very similar, serve in intergenerational poverty on that commission. We talk about incarceration rates, homelessness, all of these issues. And we constantly talk about getting upstream of those issues and what can we do. And I remember having this conversation, I think, with John at one point, where I said, you know, what I've learned in my years of service is that, you know, if we want to keep people off the streets and out of jail, we need them to graduate from high school. We know that. If you look at the data, if they graduate from high school, they're far less likely to fall into those terrible situations. So how do we get people to graduate from high school? Well, it turns out if you're on pace by eighth grade, right, you're much more likely to graduate from high school. So how do we do that? Well, if you can read by third grade, you're much more likely to be on pace by eighth grade. How do we do that? Well, if you come to kindergarten and you know enough words, right, we know. So what I've learned is that's where we need to go. We really need to focus, and we haven't historically been as focused as we should on preparing our young people for what's to come in those critical years. Now, I also want to note that the people around this room are doing the work. And we recognize that. We have private providers, we have nonprofits, we have so many incredible people that are doing the lifting and shaping these young people and solving problems. This commission is not meant to replace that in any way. It's not meant to take away from that in any way. It's merely meant to help the state understand what's happening, to coordinate better, to make sure that we have opportunities. And I believe it will help you get the resources you need in a much better fashion as we all work together. So I'll stop talking, but I just wanted to provide that by way of introduction and an explanation. Now, I need to know this, that the governor's office assigned an MOA with the Department of Workforce Services to provide staff support, so we appreciate John Pierpont and his team working closely with us to help provide that staff. Karen Peterson will be serving as commission staff as well on behalf of the executive branch. We really believe that this arrangement will provide the linkage to the work that's happening in the governor's office. And so with that, let's go ahead and have the commission members introduce themselves if we could. John, do you want to start? Sure. We'll just go around.
John Pierpont, executive director for the Department of Workforce Services.
And Tracy, you're,
oh,
go ahead.
Tracy Gruber, Department of Workforce Services staff in the Office of Child Care.
Montana Myers, Office of Child Care.
Good afternoon. Ann Silverberg Williamson, Executive Director for Utah's Department of Human Services.
Good afternoon. I'm Cindy Goodson, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Hi, I'm Joe Miner, Executive Director, Utah Department of Health.
And I'm Mann Milner, and I serve in the Utah State Senate.
And I'm Karen Peterson. I'm the Deputy Education Advisor, but I'll be serving as staff for this commission.
All right. Thank you. Now, we need to be sworn in. We need to have the oath of office. And I think Kathy's here to do that for us. So we'll make it official. Thank you. I will note there's a lot of administrative, because this is the first meeting, there's a whole bunch of administrative stuff we have to go through to get a commission up and running. So we'll be patient. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. And following the actual administration of the oath, I will just come around to each of you individually and have you sign the oath as well as the notary journal. So if you wouldn't mind all standing and raise your hand, and you can just repeat after me. I state your name.
I, Spencer Cox.
Having been appointed to the office of board member.
Having been appointed to the office of board member.
Of the Governor's Early Childhood Commission.
Of the Governor's Early Childhood Commission.
Do solemnly swear that I will support, obey, and defend.
Do solemnly swear that I will support, obey, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Utah.
The Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Utah.
And that I will discharge the duties of my office with fidelity.
And that I will discharge the duties of my
office. That's one of the two of us. We got one together here.
Right? Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
The office of my duties. That's something
I start with fidelity.
Okay, thank you. And we, again, we'll have people sign that as we go around. All right, moving right along, we will now turn the time over to Senator Ann Milner to talk about HB 47, to give the context and the intent of the bill. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. This is pretty exciting to see. It's been a long journey. When I first came into the legislature, kind of interesting enough, one of the things that I got sent off to was an early learning institute that NCSL does. And it's pretty interesting for me because I've had exactly the same journey that the Lieutenant Governor's had, that I spent a lot of time on the higher ed side. And we always talked about high school, but then you just start making this journey back and start to realize that what we do for the youngest of our children really kind of sets the stage for their opportunities going forward, and how thinking through how we best make sure we meet their needs is critically important. So when I came back and had time to start talking to people, I realized that we have lots of resources, lots of people providing resources, but I wasn't sure. I mean, I didn't know about those resources, and I knew lots of other people that didn't know about those resources, and so decided that it was probably important for us to at least understand what was available in the state to support our parents as they support their children, because we all know that we believe in Utah that parents is the first teacher and the one who provides that support, but oftentimes our parents need help and support. We need to think about how we do that in the right way and how we can coordinate that work so parents can even know it's available. So I ran a bill, 2017 legislature, that asked for just creating an inventory of the resources there, looking at how people were aligning and coordinating that work and making recommendations about what are some of our gaps might be and how do we begin to think about how we should be doing this work going forward. And one of the recommendations that came out of that report was really saying we need to have stronger mechanisms. We don't need to create new programs. We have lots of programs and lots of really good programs in the state. But what we do need to think about is how do we better kind of coordinate and align our work and work together and make sure that we're communicating well with our parents about what those resources are in a coordinated way. So one particular organization may have an interface with somebody, but the reality is they may need other resources that are in other organizations. And how do we create a really good handoff process? So a physician, a pediatrician, sees a child and knows that maybe the parent needs some more help and support, and they're able to even say, here's how, you know, here's some places that you could find some additional help and support to help you do your work. And we just need to kind of connect people through communication, through coordination, and alignment. So as a result of that, House Bill 47 went through the legislature this past session and authorized kind of two elements. It authorized and actually put in code what's already been there with the advisory board. The advisory board had been formed, but it really hadn't been formalized in code, and so we did that because we know that that's a good way to get providers talking and communicating about their work and trying to connect with each other to enhance this work. But we also felt there needed to be a second kind of a commission, particularly among all of our state agencies as we do this work. And as we connect out with our private providers of this work, how do we connect better together and coordinate that work, and how do we reach out? So I think you can think about this along the lines of things like the Intergenerational Poverty Initiative, trying to really draw that work together, getting a group of people focused on other ways that we better can connect and align. And so I'm really excited to see this. I know that you're all advocates of our kids and wanting to make sure they have every opportunity they can have to be able to succeed in life, and helping them really get that foundational piece that they need to be able to do that is really important. So thank you all for being here, for being part of this. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, for, I know, thinking about how you invest your time is like not an easy decision, and making this a priority. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
I think it's a priority for Utah.
Yeah, it is, and it was an easy decision for me. So thank you. Thank you, Senator, for your leadership. We appreciate it. Recognize that Senator Miller has other obligations and may need to leave early. Feel free to leave at any time. You're fine. So thank you. Thank you. Okay, so again, in the spirit of trying to get the board up and running, under the statute, it is required that that I appoint a vice chair. However, the commission does get to approve my appointment. And so I have
there.
We go south very quickly.
Very quickly.
John, I did, since his organization is helping us staff, I asked John Pierpont if he'd be willing to serve as a vice chair. He agreed, but you get to decide if that's a wise choice or not. So I would look for an approval. It'd be a little less awkward.
You want me to leave the room?
Okay. You do get a big pay raise if this goes through.
Yeah.
He does not get a pay raise. We do not reduction debt. Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Many opposed. All right, it's official. Okay. Also under statute, we have to go through and adopt the rules of order and procedure. And so we've asked Karen. She'll walk us through the highlights of the proposed rules, and any discussion will be well received. So please.
Okay, great. It is a lot of housekeeping today, so bear with us while we kind of work through all of this. But we need to adopt some rules of orders and procedures. I'm just going to highlight a couple of things that, as I've sat on board, sometimes, you know, after the board gets going, you think, wait, how does this board do that? So I just wanted to highlight a few of those things. The first is, per the statute, a deputy director may be designated to be the commission member. So you've all been sworn in now, so you are now the commission member. If you need to send someone because you have another obligation, we have a process for proxy, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but you are now the commission member unless someone else is sworn in your place. So I wanted you to all understand that. If you'll flip the next page over, just on meeting, scheduling, and noticing, I'm really encouraged by how many of the public found us today. So we've done tried to really reach out to all of you that are here to let you know we want you to be here. There's a good process for subscribing to these meetings online, and we would encourage you to do that. And if you don't know how to do that, contact myself or Montana, and we'll get you hooked up with how you can subscribe to the meeting. So if there's any changes, you'll be made aware. And, of course, we're following all the Open Public Meetings Act laws and noticing. So that's for the public. Just be aware that's all available to you.
And I'm glad you pointed that out. I just want to reiterate that this is a public meeting on purpose, and we want you here. We hope you'll come or send designees so that we're aware and we are communicating.
Perfect. Yeah. As far as establishing the agenda, I think we can be probably fairly informal. If there's things you want to talk about, please reach out, and I'll discuss that with Lieutenant Governor, and we'll build that agenda. If there's ever anything else, though, and you want to bring it up in this meeting by a majority vote, we can place something on the next agenda. So that's one of our rules and procedures. If we have our next action is actually going to be approve electronic meetings. So if you ever can't be here but are able to call in, we're going to approve that. But I do need probably 2 days' notice that you're going to do that, so I can have the phone prepared and we can have that set up with capital preservation. So, and that would just be my ask of you. We're just going to follow very standard meetings and motions. I think all of you are sit on a lot of boards, so no unusual motions. In your binder that Montana's prepared for you, there's a handbook that our office puts together for members of boards and commissions, and there's a whole outline on motion. So we'll leave that in our binder, so if we ever get caught off on motion, we'll have that available as a resource. Like I said, you are allowed to send a proxy, but we're going to ask that you only send the people that are listed in statute, so your deputies, basically, so that if a proxy is coming for you, it's still reflective of what the statute wanted. So if you do send a proxy, let us know in advance that a proxy is coming. We'd appreciate that, and probably limit that to your deputies. And the final thing is, sometimes as we get going, that last page talks about amendments and revisions. If there's something that's not working for our commission, we have a process to change any of these rules and procedures to make them reflect the work that we need to do. So those are just kind of the highlights.
Hey, any questions? All right, seeing none, again, very standard for most of our commission. I do need a motion, though, to approve this.
I will move, Lieutenant Governor, that we adopt the rules of order and procedure as presented.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Miner. Is there a
second?
Thank you, John. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes unanimously. As was mentioned, we do want to provide electronic meeting allowances, and so we need to adopt that as well. Any discussion?
No, this is just a pretty standard resolution that we use to adopt electronic meetings. There's nothing in there you probably haven't seen before.
Okay. Refer motion to adopt. We have a motion and a second. Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion also carries unanimously. Okay, moving on to the next agenda item. We want to talk about the statutory training, and we have to have some training. I think Scott is here with us from the Attorney General's office. Scott, welcome. It's great
Thank
to
you.
Have you here. We get to run in a few circles together, so
it's my pleasure.
It'll be a fun one. Scott is going to give us some training on GRAMA, the Government Records and Management Act, as well as the Open and Public Records Act, and then we'll talk about ethics. So, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I need to say at the outset that I understand that all of you are on several boards and commissions, and that you serve in department head capacity, and so it's not presumed that anything I have to say here is something that's new to you by any means. However, it is, as the Lieutenant Governor pointed out, a statutory requirement under the Open Public Meetings Act that all boards and commissions take on some annual training. And in the spirit of all of the formalities that we've seen today, we're wanting to cross that off as well. And so I've placed next to your handbooks there, each of you, a couple of handouts that will address the Open Public Meetings Act, the Public Officers Employees Ethics Act, and the Governor's Executive Order 2014 relating to ethics in public service. I certainly don't mean to reread or go over in fine detail any of these provisions, and I welcome any questions or comments that you have, but with that, let's jump into some of the as you know, and I think everybody in this room who works in for the public is well aware that the intention of all of these statutes is that government occur in the open, and that it invites not only rigorous and well-informed discourse, but that it also invites public confidence in the system and in the process. And these statutes are intended for all of our state government to be aware of those goals and to provide public discourse on all of these items of important public work. And so the first one here, the Officers and Employees Ethics Act, does essentially, I don't want to say it too hardly, but the word is prohibit. The word and the Ethics Act prohibits those of us who are in voluntary or employment position with the state to avoid the appearance of using our position for self-serving reasons or for serving family and close associates. So the Act essentially prohibits, first of all, improper disclosure of controlled information. That is information that is particularly confined to this body, and the disclosure of that information in the corporate world, we call it insider trading or insider evidence. The Ethics Act kind of colloquially prohibits using our positions in that respect and precludes us from disclosing information that others might use that information for profit. As you're well aware, the Ethics Act also prohibits receiving gifts because of your title or your position. And of course, there are a lot of exceptions and a lot of kind of details about that. But generally speaking, a gift of substantive value, which the statute generally calls $50 or more, is something that we're prohibited from taking. And there are exceptions to that, and you know, receiving an award or a memorial or a certificate or a plaque for your public service is something that's exempted from the statute. But just be aware again that those prohibitions are statutory and mandatory. The Act also prevents board members from earning compensation, and I guess with the exception of the vice chair here, who apparently received it. All of you act in a voluntary position, and despite your other employment with the state and state agencies, your service on this commission is voluntary, and it's a prohibition to receive compensation for sitting on the board. And finally, turning kind of more towards the governor's executive order there, in addition to these three things that I just mentioned, the governor's executive order prohibits what it calls nepotism in employment and contracting, and essentially says that we can't give favors to family members or kind of in-law, distant family members in contracting or employment with the state. And so to the extent that this board is ever involved in contracting or approving contracts, the way to do that properly and to continue to participate in any sort of decisions relating to those contracting or employment, there's a disclosure requirement. And so if you do see yourself as having any sort of familial or kind of economic contact with an entity that may be contracting with the state, then you should disclose that. And I have some forms that I'll give to Montana, and she can circulate those as necessary. But that's one way to meet the statutory obligations. Okay. The Open Public Meetings Act is alive and well with this board, and obviously Karen and Montana and staff have published this, given notice of this meeting on the public notice website. And for the record, this is a public body as defined under the Open Public Meetings Act, and therefore all of your meetings should be conducted publicly. That means first that notice goes out. Notice happens by way of the public notice website. It should be offered to newspaper of general circulation, and as is outside the door here, posted on the location of the meeting. All of those have happened here, and I suspect will continue to happen. The second broad requirement of the Open Public Meetings Act is that we keep a record, and that record, the official record of these meetings, will be kept in minutes, and the recording of the meetings will all be posted on the public website within 3 days of meetings, and then minutes, written minutes, will be drafted and adopted and approved at the next meeting, and those minutes become the official record of all of the meetings and actions of the board, and will also be made public as a public record. The statute goes into closed meetings. There's a long list of particular discussion topics that may trigger the board's wanting to close a public meeting. The procedure for doing that is there has to be a motion at an open meeting like this that is approved by a majority of the quorum. And so you vote to close the meeting, and then you hold a closed session for discussion of only those topics that are outlined and allowed in the statute. I don't know that any of those topics will generally be on the agenda for this board, but to the extent that that's information you need in your other working groups, that's important information. There are, as you've already done, you passed a resolution to allow for electronic meetings. That is, if one of you can't attend in person, you can attend by phone with the appropriate notice and stuff. The statute does require that boards and commissions pass a resolution to allow that in order for that to happen. And so it's good to get it up front here as a formality at the beginning of this board. And then the violations. If someone knowingly violates the OPMA statute, it can be a misdemeanor. It can result in fines. The more probable result is that someone could challenge any action taken, and the board would have 30 days to turn around and reconvene and take action according to the Open Public Meetings Act and to rectify any sort of oversights that might occur there. Okay, one final statute that we need to mention, and I should point out that all of this stuff is included, at least in summary fashion, in the handbook for board members that's been included in your binders here. And it's a great reference, and I think it's really a valuable little handbook here. But on pages 7 through 10, 9 of that, talks briefly about the Grandma Statute, Government Records Access Management Act. The basic gist of that is that the acts of the board and information and documents that you receive, including electronic documents and communications, and those documents that you receive kind of in your official capacity as members of the board, these become public records, and therefore are it's important that you retain the records. Now, again, not individually necessarily, but that the staff will help you and the board will retain those records, and that those records then become subject to public disclosure according to the various provisions of the Grandma Statute. And that, again, is something that staff typically handles. But the gist is, when you get official-looking documents, before you take your copy and do with it as you would, make sure that staff has a copy of that and can keep that as a record of the board. Board members' notes and memoranda. These are exceptions, by the way. Board members' notes and memoranda from an adjudicative proceeding. Board members' notes and daily calendars prepared for your own personal use aren't generally government records. And junk mail and commercial communications, flyers and things aren't necessarily government records either. On that point, I do want to make another mention too, that communications amongst yourselves relating to the official business of the board, whether that communication happens by text on your phone, by email on your laptop, your personal laptop or tablet, the communications that you make in writing in your capacity as board members is our government records, and therefore are subject to retention and disclosure at some point. And so to the extent that worries you about having your personal phone handed over to Karen if she has to respond to a grammar request. That's a possibility, I guess, is what I want everybody to be aware of. And it's just a trend of the times, I think, because of the way technology has allowed us to communicate so immediately and quickly all the time. And so if you can talk the state into giving you a dedicated cell phone or laptop that you can use just for your official business, that's probably the best way to go. But there are times when, you know, you also have to say, we're meeting right now, where are you, and are you prepared, what can I do to help, so to speak. And and so those communications also are government records. And so with that, any questions you have, I'm happy to entertain. Otherwise, I'd let you get back to your real business.
Thank you, Scott. Any questions? Okay. I think we're good to go. I appreciate it. Thank you. All right. Don't mess it up. Let's move on to item number 5. We're going to talk about the responsibilities of the commission and the timelines as well for our interim report. So Karen's going to walk us through the bill and some of the requirements there.
Okay, so I created this handout here. You have it in your binders. And I just kind of want to talk through my thought process, and then if anyone's smarter in the room and they have better ideas, then I'll be open to those. So as I took on this responsibility to staff the commission, of course, the first thing I did was reread HB 47. And as I was doing that, I started creating this checklist of responsibilities for our commission, and I thought, oh, this would be nice to provide. It became overwhelming very quickly to say, we have 2 pages of items that we need to check off. And then the more I thought about those items, they're not check-off items. They're ongoing items, things we're going to be continually needing to work on and review and go back. And so my thought process was that we kind of need to separate out the statute into, our first step is going to be to kind of engage, to have these opportunities, have conversations with the public, to study and to look into what's already happening, you know, and kind of build this sense of community within this commission, so that as we go on to identify and act and meet those criteria outlined in the statute, that we're in a position to continue to engage throughout this process as we identify and act and do those things required in the statute. So so these items under each heading are directly from the statute. So these are our responsibilities, but put in a way that I hope will help us roll this forward more strategically, rather than try to do all things at once or start doing one-off things here and there that aren't connected to what we would like to do. So the first part, directly engage with families, seek regular feedback. I think we're going to need to establish systems to do those things. In Early Childhood Utah, the advisory committee for that is going to be thinking through a process where they can send us recommendations and thoughts. That's a great way that we'll be able to engage with a broader audience in kind of a structured way. But we are going to all need to be thinking together about how we reach all of the groups within our state and not just those that maybe always are at the table. So think about those kind of things. The next things that we're tasked with are kind of the study and evaluate and identify. So each of us sit in a place where we read a lot of policies, we establish a lot of policies, we run a lot of programs, those kind of things. So that's going to be kind of our next step then. Once we've kind of set this system where we have feel like we can get feedback, then we can start thinking about things that are inefficient or things that are impeding the efforts, the things that we want to accomplish. And then finally, we'll have the opportunity to make recommendations, to inform a comprehensive policy, to talk about budget decisions. But I think that those things are going to have to come as we put these other steps in place. So this is just kind of my thought process on what your duties and responsibilities are here on this commission and how a way we can kind of roll these out. The nice thing is we're going to talk today about some ongoing work that's already happening in our state that will help us do these things. So we don't have to start with nothing for all of these things. Tracy's going to talk a little bit about a grant we've received and some ongoing work. Those will help us as we move through this kind of continuum there. So, and I want to say, my other thought was, too, at the end of the day, if we're doing all these things, we've engaged, we're identifying, and we're acting,
and families in Vernal and Ogden haven't felt the difference in accessing high-quality services, then we've missed something. So as we go along, let's think about how we actually can think about the impact that this commission can have on those families and actually, you know, not just talk amongst ourselves, but actually make a difference in the lives of those families and those children. So think, too, about how we can measure those things. What are some leading indicators and things that we can measure right from the beginning? What are our baselines? Where are we missing that? So as we go forward, we can make sure we really are impacting those families, and what we're doing will matter. So,
thank
just
you.
Kind of a, yeah. Okay, and then I want to talk through.
Any questions on that before we move on?
So the next page just kind of talks about the timeline. I just wanted you aware of some of the deadlines in statute and some of the ongoing work. So if you'll look, Tracy's going to talk a little bit about the preschool development grant that we've already qualified for and some new funding that's opened up. We're not going to probably get too deep into that today, but I just want you aware that that work is happening. On October 1st, we were required by statute to turn in an interim report. So I'm going to cover 5C at the same time, which is we had to already turn in an interim report. So we did that by submitting it through the Department of Workforce Services is required to submit an interim report. So we put our portion into that report, and the second page here is the report that I submitted for our group, which mostly says we plan to convene a meeting on October 2nd. There's some ongoing work, and, you know, We're ready to go, but we haven't quite done too much to report on yet. But I wanted you to be aware that we did meet the statutory obligation there. But the report's pretty sparse right now. But hopefully we'll have some more later. And then the next thing is some of the activities that we're going to be talking about today. I wanted you to know when they will be completed. So in October, we have the Ken Gardner Institute and the Sorenson Impact Center working on a needs assessment for our state, which will be really helpful as we move forward. And in fact, today you're going to hear about the qualitative piece related to that. So that work can kind of be concluding in November. In December, the strategic plan will be able to come forward. And so I anticipate our December meeting will be a lot of our December meeting, discussing that strategic plan and thinking of where we'd like to move next. One of the other activities we have funded through a grant is kind of building a web platform, kind of a wireframe on if we're going to have a more robust website. That activity was funded through the grant, and that should be completed in December, right? We'll have to talk about when we schedule our meetings, you know, for the next calendar year. We'll anticipate meeting in December. I am guessing we'll probably meet again post-session. And then we'll need to meet quarterly, so 4 times a year. So I'm thinking probably in March will be our December, and then probably March, and then we'll schedule out those meetings. Early Childhood Utah is also going to be working on a state needs assessment, and that has to be completed by August 1st of 2020. So I think there's some pieces that will help us move this work forward, but I just kind of wanted you to see that where I think we're headed and where we're going and how we're going to meet the obligations of the statute. So that's all for that.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Next up, as was mentioned, Tracy, with the director of the Office of Child Care in UWS, is going to give us a presentation on the current landscape in early childhood in Utah. So, Tracy.
Thank you. And like Scott said, I'm presuming that there's some of this is repeat knowledge for all of you, but just to kind of get us all grounded as we start off on the early childhood system and a little bit of background on where we've been and where we're going. As Senator Milner said, she started off on this in 2017, and in 2017, the Department of Workforce Services was required to do an early childhood services study, which you have in your binders under the tab, Early Childhood Services Study. This was a first effort for creating a statewide need assessment, and we partnered with the Utah Education Policy Center at that time to help us write that report to shape a better understanding of what's going on in early childhood in our state. And I would say Utah is not unique in that early childhood is cut across multiple state agencies and across multiple federal funding streams. So this is a challenge nationwide, which is why there's such a big effort to try to coordinate these services a little bit better. And through that early childhood services study, we created a framework, which you have in front of you. And the framework looked at data. This should look familiar to many of you because it kind of models after the Intergenerational Poverty Report, in that with so many pieces of data and so many programs out there, it's organized into four kind of domains. There's the family support and safety, health and development, early learning, and economic stability. And then on the back side, you see that there are goals that are established in each of those areas. And the way that these goals evolved was not from DWS and the Office of Child Care exclusively. It was really done in partnership with Early Childhood Utah, which we're going to talk a little bit more about a little bit later in the meeting. So there are these four domains with these four goals. This evolved in 2017. Fast forward to a grant that the state received called the Preschool Development Grant, Birth to Five, which is a federally funded grant with five very specific activities that I'll talk about a little bit later. But in order for us to execute the requirements of that grant, we partnered with the Kemp C. Gardner Policy Institute. And that work was conducted by Samantha Ball, who just joined us, and the Sorensen Impact Center up at the university, both up at the University of Utah and Allison Nicholson, who's also here. Samantha and the Policy Institute did the qualitative piece of the needs assessment, and the Sorensen Impact Center is doing the quantitative piece. But hot off the presses, before completion of the full report, Allison sent me this great roadmap of Utah's early childhood system, and if you look at it, you can kind of get a sense as to why you all are sitting around the table. So within each of these areas, the four areas that we focused on, what she first did is if you look at the state, all of the boxes are the same color before they get split off on the back. You can see each of our state agencies and which piece of the early childhood service structure each of our agencies are meeting, are implementing. And then if you flip it over and you look at those four domains of early learning, health and development, family support and safety, economic stability, you kind of can see how in meeting the needs of the families in the state of Utah, there's multiple programs across multiple state agencies, which means I would say you have to have a PhD to know how to navigate. And maybe if you have one,
right?
You still can't navigate. I don't know. So this gives us a pretty good sense of what we're trying to tackle in our current structure to help shape a more coordinated and aligned early childhood system in our state to better meet the needs of our families and make sure that young children have their needs across all of these domains met. So that's a pretty high level overview of the system in its current state. Each of you and your staff have a pretty significant piece of that. In the work moving forward, this is an excellent starting point. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Dr. Mayer.
I have a comment. WIC, under economic stability, they do receive vouchers for food, but it's more of a health assessment and nutrition education and coaching, mentoring. So it almost belongs under health and development more than economic stability, even though they do receive vouchers for just limited nutritious foods. It's mostly a physical assessment, nutrition assessment, coaching, counseling, mentoring parents, and so forth. So that would be just one comment I had.
That's great feedback, and if anything on here feels like it needs to be moved around, I think we were trying to figure out what need it's mostly meeting. I mean, childcare is another good example. I think that's one we've struggled with. Is it an early learning program? Is it a economic work support program? So
it's kind of both.
It's kind of both. So if for you as the leads in your agencies feel we'd rather see something in a different category, we're happy to move that around.
We just want you to add another comment. We add another color.
Other questions, comments?
It's well done. Thanks.
Yeah, no, it's very helpful to see it all in one place. And daunting at the same time,
right.
Somehow. So. Thank you, Tracy. All right, let's go ahead then, and we'll move to item number 7, the state initiatives around early childhood. Karen, go ahead. That's you.
Perfect. So, like we've been talking, there's a lot of momentum already in this space, and a lot of work has already been happening and continues to happen. So I wanted to make you aware of just two efforts that that are happening right now, that so we can just be mindful of those as we move forward. The first is not so much, I guess, as an effort, as an ongoing established committee, which is Early Childhood Utah, which resides in the Department of Health. And this committee has been, this advisory council has been in existence for, I can't even tell you how long, a long time. I know that the executive order was in 2011, designating it as one of our advisory councils, but I think it's existed longer than that as part of the Head Start Act. So when the HB 47 passed, that advisory committee was codified then. And I want to make sure that we understand that that they're going to be integral to our work, that we're not separate. As much as we are separate, you know, Tracy and I will both be on Early Childhood Utah. Each of you have people that are also serving on that. And they are thinking through a process whereby they can send us recommendations, which is also called out specifically in the statute. So I want you to know that they're there, that they've been there. The great thing about this advisory council specifically is that it's a good place to give voice to many of those working in the sector that have some great expertise. So they can come, they can be part of that, and they can sit on by appointment, you know, on this committee. And it gives an opportunity for us to hear from our private providers and also some of our families so we can inform this work. So I want you to know that they exist, that they're here. I didn't know if everyone was aware. And I think actually many of them came today. So if you're on Early Childhood Utah, can you raise your hand? I just kind of want them to see. So thank you for being here. Nicole Bissonnette is their project manager, and she's out of town today, so she couldn't be here. But we appreciate them being here and also supporting us, because I think it's going to be really helpful that they bring that voice, especially of our private practitioners. And then this other effort I wanted to make you aware of is the governor has long had the Education Excellence Commission, and if you've ever seen this, hopefully you have. This is a work that the governor's commission has done. So the commission is made up of public education, higher education. It is made up of industry, parents, charter schools. We've had people, Pam Perlick, that served on it. It's a good kind of cross-sector of people who are engaged and interested in education in Utah, and not just K-12, but education generally. And so a couple of years ago, we undertook this work, which was to say what things, you know, the State Board of Education, what does their strategic plan look like? What are the things that are important to them? What about higher education? What about our technical colleges? We took all of those plans, the things that people are working on, and we talked about what is important, what works best, what are things that are cross-sector that we need to work together on to be efficient. And we kind of came up with four different areas that we wanted to talk about, which were ensure early learning, strengthen and support educators, ensure access and equity, and complete certificates and degrees. There's something that all of us had a touch point on, and industry, of course, was also engaged. Above all of that is innovation and collaboration, that we need to continue to work together to innovate, and nothing can happen without family and community support, but that's why we do what we do. After this document came out, each year that commission has kind of taken on a different area of focus that they would like to work on. So 2 years ago, they talked about students who are at risk of academic failure. And we talked through what some of the strategies that this plan outlines that we wanted to focus on. And then during the legislative session, we worked with our members of the legislature. And 2 years ago, we had some additional funding put into our, it's called the EARS program, the Enhancement for At-Risk Students. And we also kind of looked through how those students were defined. So that was what they did 2 years ago. Last year, we talked a lot about safe and healthy schools and how we create that for our students. One of the things that we then worked on this last session was, with Steve Ellison working on his bill, that provides additional funding for mental health in our schools, and it's a substantial amount, $16 million this year and $26 million going forward, and how we can support our students. So I'm giving you that background because this year, the commission, before this commission was even created, the governor's commission has decided to work on early childhood, how we support kids in that early childhood space. So that's kind of been their focus this past year. So I just wanted to give you kind of four slides that we talked about in our meeting about a month ago, yeah, when the governor was there. And so you know that this work is happening, so you can be aware. So within this, the roadmap, there are strategies under each of these areas that we know, things that we know work. There's a lot of strategies, though, so you kind of have to prioritize and decide which ones we're going to work forward first. So we have been kind of tracking these strategies and which ones we've been making progress on, which ones we haven't started, and which ones are ongoing. So that first slide there were the strategies specifically to early childhood. And one of those strategies was to do the coordinated report, SB 100, that we did. So that's one of those strategies that we have worked on. We had a working group that kind of thought about early learning, and it was led by Dr. Ruth Watkins, the president of the U. That's her background, actually, is in early childhood. So she was gracious enough to lead a working group that United Way and DWS and this state board all participated on to talk about how can we influence early learning. And there were three initiatives that they discussed at EdExcellence. First of all, improving the quality of instruction in K-3, extending time, expanding access to optional extended-day kindergarten, and finally, early access to high-quality preschool. So as this commission is kind of still in the what is our strategy going to be for the session space, but I did want you to just see these two slides, because as I looked at this slide, the first one on improving the quality of instruction, these are kind of strategies that the state board has talked through for how we improve, you know, the in-classroom instruction and those types of things. But I thought these are also applicable also to, as we talk about what high-quality preschool looks like, what high-quality learning looks like before a student even enters the school building. So how do we support these kind of strategies so that our students and our children get some high-quality instruction and our educators are supported in giving that? Another thing to consider on that second strategy on optional extended-day kindergarten. So that second slide, about 40% of Utah students are coming to kindergarten at risk for academic failure. Only about half are being served through our extended learning opportunities in kindergarten. And I know Sid can probably speak to this. The board is also having this conversation as they work through their legislative priorities on what that would look like and what that would cost to expand that to specifically to that population that we know exists, the at-risk population throughout our state. And if you're not familiar with optional extended-day kindergarten, it doesn't mean always full-day kindergarten. It doesn't mean they always go like a first grader or second grader or third grader. Sometimes just some extra time so that those students can get a little bit more support. And we've had local control on that issue and how they can accommodate that. But I think that I anticipate they're going to make a motion regarding this as far as what their focus will be this session. And so I just wanted you aware that that work was happening so that, because I think it will probably end up coming to this commission as well if they move forward in that direction.
And I would just add to that, a lot of the strategies on the roadmap on the front page overlap with some of the work going on in the Intergenerational Welfare Reform Commission. So there's a nice kind of linkage and the priorities that you all set out in the Welfare Reform Commission, bringing back to the Governor's Education Excellence Commission, and then, of course, here now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's all I have for that. But
that's great. Thank you. Any questions? Yes, please sit. Yeah.
Just for the good of the group, one of the, I don't know if it's a challenge and an opportunity that in our state, you know, we're one of the few states that doesn't govern pre-K-12. When you look at most states in their constitution or whatever governing document they use to govern public education, it's PK-12. So any recommendations that we make in the pre-K space, in the preschool space, we sort of overlap our constitutional boundaries of doing so because we think it's important. So we make recommendations, we try to engage with the community as best we can in the pre-space, and you'll see a lot of preschools in our public schools emerging. Some have been they've been there for a long time. We've had preschool for students with disabilities, developmentally delayed, et cetera, for a long time. But it hasn't been a common practice in this state to see preschool in our public schools, and that's emerging more and more as people are able to get funding for those programs. It's not funded in our K-12 system. So I just put that out there, that the legislative levers, the policy levers, where we've had like the partnerships, quality pre-K partnerships, and some of the things that have been done, have provided us ways to leverage pre-K partnerships with our public schools. That's like, we just do it anyway, but that is a policy lever to just always keep in the back of our minds, that we are not a pre-K-12 state when it comes to that type of governance structure.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Thank you for the update. Tracy, you want to talk about the development grant?
Sure. This will be very quick. Under tab 7C, there's a one-page summary about the preschool development grant 4-5 that I mentioned just very briefly. This was a grant that the state applied for a year ago. That's actually a grant that's both from the Federal Office of Child Care and the U.S. Department of Education. In this round of funding, it came from the Federal Office of Child Care. In the past, it was from U.S. Department of Ed for preschool SEEP, actually. When they released the new funding last year, it was really for states to build this coordinated and aligned system, and there were five activities for which you could seek funding. This one-pager explains the grant that was received by the state of Utah that's being managed out of the Department of Workforce Services, and the activities that we have committed to as a state. And although it's being awarded through the Department of Workforce Services, it's really been across multi-partner stakeholder exercise. It's starting with both the qualitative and quantitative needs assessment. So even though we had that first early childhood services study, that was a pretty quick turnaround. I think we had 6 months, if I'm not mistaken, to get that needs assessment conducted. We felt that having a comprehensive needs assessment that built on that first one was critically important to the state as we embarked on building this early childhood system. So we requested funding to have a more sophisticated and elaborate needs assessment, more comprehensive, I should say. And what we did was we not only wanted to get a quantitative needs assessment, how many children are served throughout what states and in which programs, but also what was the public and our partners saying about the early childhood system. So we did a qualitative needs assessment that Samantha's going to talk about. From that, we have to develop a strategic plan, and the vision is to take that needs assessment. You'll hear about the quantitative needs assessment when it's completed. Early Childhood Utah will also be taking that quantitative needs assessment and developing a strategic plan that will eventually make its way up to this group to see a little bit more about, maybe as a strategy, how we can build that system. Then there were two other additional components that we received funding for. The activity number that's listed under 3, maximizing parent knowledge and choice. Karen mentioned the development of a universal early childhood website. So not only do we have a map that looks like this of all of our programs, the website structure or the internet structure of all these programs is probably even more mind-boggling. It probably take up this whole room. So one of the things that we thought was, from a parent's perspective, in order to know where to get resources, many parents would not know what SNAP or WIC or which agency to go to, which is responsible for which program, that at the very least we can start designing a universal website. Not implementing it, but at least using some funds to see what we would envision as a state if we had a universal website for our families. That's under development through the Department of Technology Services and the Department of Workforce Services, and we're continuing to have meetings with stakeholders to kind of build that universal website out. And then the fourth activity is sharing best practices among state early care and education providers. And the area that, of focus that we got funding on was supporting kindergarten transitions for children. We've got Head Start programs, we've got private child care providers, we've got public pre-K programs. Eventually, these kiddos are all entering the K-12 system, where expectations of kindergarten readiness are pretty high, and how do we support those families transitioning their children in the birth through five space into the K-12 system. So there's going to be some kindergarten transition summits that we're partnering with the State Board of Education in the coming month or two, I think, December, I think, in order to start laying the groundwork of how do we effectively support children in their kindergarten, in their transition to kindergarten, and their parents and the teachers who are receiving them. So that's a high, again, trying to keep stay out of the weeds, which is hard for me to do, high level of what the preschool development grant for through five was for 1 year worth of funding. They did just release the second round of funding for years two through four that the state will have to make a determination as to whether or not it's going to seek those additional funds and for what activities. The first round of funding is through December, but we understand that there's going to be an opportunity for a couple months extension that I think all the states are going to be seeking. But the next round of funding is currently out, and the state will just have to discuss and make a determination about seeking that second round of funding. So any questions on that grant?
Thank you. With that in mind, we are going to have a presentation now on the qualitative needs assessment that was done. We're very excited to have Dr. Samantha Ball here with us, and we'll go ahead and turn the time to you.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
And we'll fire up the...
Okay.
Let's see. 60% of the time it works.
Got my fingers crossed over here. Oh, I think there's going to be something.
Oh, it's starting to warm
enough.
Yeah.
There we go. It just slowly comes to life. So I'm just here to do a brief overview of the qualitative report that Tracy just referenced. Is it the first button up here that would move it? What did you say?
Oh, point number.
It worked in testing.
There you go.
Okay.
We started at about the beginning of the year, and we had a three-part process for our report. The first was two early childhood service leader round discussion roundtables, and we also supplemented that with 10 individual interviews, in-depth interviews with other leaders. We used their insights to create a discussion guide. And then we used that discussion guide to go out to 10 different deliberative sessions and talk to parents and local providers about their experiences with early childhood services and their feelings about coordination and alignment. So 14 early childhood service leaders participated in the two discussion roundtables, and we did have the 10 individual in-depth interviews.
So those were spread across the state?
Yes. So the discussion roundtables, they took place just here in Salt Lake.
Right.
But the deliberative groups were throughout the state, and I'll give an overview of each of the places that we went. So, yeah. This is just a quick takeaways from the discussion roundtable. So what we used to inform our discussion guide for the groups around the state. The first was that families need a one-stop shop, like Tracy was just referring to with the website, someplace where they could come website-wise or physically to get all of their information, to just tell their story and provide their data one time and find out what services they may be eligible for. Another thing that was agreed upon was that there was a real need for better data, something that you could aggregate and make sure that you understood whether it was a single child or multiple children going through the system in different ways. And that doing that would require a universal ID number, and there might be privacy and security concerns about that. So that was one of the things we would ask about. Educating the public. One of the concerns that came up and then was kind of just underscored when we went to the deliberative groups is that I think there's been a big growth of understanding of the science of cognitive development in these early years, and people know how important it is for kids to get services in a really timely way when they're young, and yet a lot of parents just are not aware of what these milestones are, and through our work we even found that they're not necessarily finding it out, even if they're attending their well-child check and that kind of thing. So that's a concern. And then also there was concern once we any efforts to educate the public should be really sensitive to cultural differences and that type of thing and be very consistent in terms of message and branding. Four was eliminate silos, which almost didn't feel like a finding because it seems like something that's been around for a while, but this is something that's really a serious problem still. People feel like this is, rather than a system, more like a great group of people that are all in separate entities and they don't always know what's going on with each other and they'd really like to, and it's just difficult to find the time. And there have been earlier efforts at collaboration, but a lot of times there's not a paid opportunity after those discussions to really do the work that would be necessary to truly collaborate. Align outcomes and findings among programs and funding streams. Even though there was a lot of discussion about inadequate funding, this one had more to do with the idea that there actually might be more opportunity for efficiency and better use of funds if there was greater alignment among programs. Design changes that address geographic and technological limitations of rural areas. We went to Price and Blanding and Cedar City, as you'll see, and it is very interesting to see how each of those communities have their own set of differences, and then of course the urban areas have a whole other set of barriers. And so the website was universally well received as an idea. Everybody likes that, but there are a lot of areas where that will be impractical for various reasons, and so one of the messages was this wouldn't be like that would solve the problem. There would need to be some backup support for some people. There need to be a place where people could go who didn't have access. And a lot of those suggestions were made by the people in the deliberative groups. Learn from shortcomings of earlier collaboration efforts. I think one of them is just the need for leadership afterwards, that there's a lot of energy and talk about collaboration, but that follow-through is difficult because people have such demanding jobs already, and having this collaboration effort on top of it is difficult. Power among entities isn't always proportionate to the population they serve. So this is just an emphasis on inclusion of all the different groups and making sure everybody has a place at the table. Aligning and centralizing without losing human focus, especially in rural areas. I think there was a concern in this one where what might make sense in an urban community where there's these few things that you're supposed to do for children might not work in rural communities, and that there's just such a lot going on there that we need to be careful not to systematize it so much that it's more difficult for those families. And this last one, this wasn't so much a finding as we were really asking the leaders to tell us what would you like to know from parents and local providers about how to better coordinate and align the systems. And so we got that feedback from them and we created an issue guide. So our process was a discussion, roundtables, interviews, framing the discussion through a guide. This is our picture of the guide. We also had it translated into Spanish. The little bright squares are just opening questions to get the conversation going. The far right was a list, and it wasn't a complete list at all because you already have that, how crazy that is. But the idea was that if they came in thinking about something like Head Start or maybe SNAP or something, they wouldn't think of all these other services that we wanted to know about. So this is just a partial list that mentioned that mental health services and disability services and TNS, all of these things were interesting to us. And also, we were very open to hearing about stories from other people, not just themselves, family or friends that had experiences that would be informative. And then these final three columns were basically just kind of the issue areas that they most wanted to learn about from parents. So where do people get their information? What do you think would be the easiest way? And in this column, I will just say, I'll talk a little bit about how we partnered with local groups to do these deliberative sessions. And because of that, these people that we were talking to have been successful in finding early childhood services, and there are people out there who have not. And so we asked the groups to kind of brainstorm with us on how you might get those people information. Access, we talked about barriers to things, transportation, business hours. We also had a really good conversation about the plan to create a one-stop shop website and what their input would be about how to use that, and also what their feeling would be about a personal ID number, any feedback about that. And the final column was improving quality. Rather than speaking about the quality of the program, this one spoke about the quality of their experience in getting services. So did they feel like they got them in a timely way? Did they get all the information they needed? Did they get referred to other services that they needed? And if so, did anyone follow up to see if you got other services? Did you ever not follow up on a service that you were that was recommended to you? Those types of questions. Ooh, that didn't turn out the way it looked before, but these are the cities we went to: Blanding, Cedar City, Honeyville, Ogden. We had two in Salt Lake. They were very different. One was largely a refugee community, so we had, in one instance, a Somali translator. We had two in Price at different times of days to appeal to different people. We had Provo and Tooele. The Honeyville group was a really interesting one. It was mostly migrant workers in a Head Start program. We looked to identify communities where there were high childhood risk factors, like childhood poverty and English language learners. And these were, we tried to also divide it evenly between rural and urban. We actually were thinking of Tooele as a little bit urban when we started, though, and it turned out more to be rural in terms of a lot of the things that they were experiencing. This is just an overview, a quick overview of what some of the characteristics. So these sessions, we reached out to local partners because it's hard to get anyone to take time. It's so hard to go to an event like this, but we tried to find partners where they were already meeting with families so that they would be trusted and they would come. We had 1 to 4 groups per location, so in some cases we were able to get only about 8 people, and in some cases there were 4 tables of 10. We were kind of going for about 6 to 8 people at a table, but it varied depending on language and that type of thing. It was 1.5 hours long. We had translators at half of the locations, and everybody was provided with snacks and $10 gift cards.
We should have had that at our meeting.
Yeah. It does. It adds a little something, doesn't it, for
$150. Under $50.
These were our local partners. 3 Head Start programs, the San Juan Foundation, Parents as Teachers, the University Neighborhood Partners, United Way, and the local county health office all helped to get these people to attend. That was incredibly helpful. These were the kind of 5 themes, if we were to say overall, what kind of bubbled up. One, as I said, that just verified what leaders were concerned about as the unknowns for parents. There are a lot of parents who just felt like they wish they would have known these were the markers, and they felt like they didn't even receive that information at their doctors, and they had a lot of ideas for where you should give this information so that people who don't know that they don't know it would encounter it. But there's also just a lack of knowledge about the existence of programs. So they don't know that there's a program out there that they would be eligible for. And sometimes with eligibility, there's unknowns in terms of if you aren't qualified for one program, you might assume that you aren't qualified for anything. And so that's another reason why a one-stop shop would be so useful, is that that wouldn't be a problem. We heard about variable income, challenging eligibility, people who get just a bonus at the end of the year and then now they don't qualify for a program anymore, or people who lost their job early in the year but they have to refer to their tax documents and it makes it look like they have more resources than they do. Word of mouth turned out to be a huge way that people find out about programs, either from their family members, friends, neighbors. There was an example where someone set up a booth at Home Depot and just pulled someone aside because they had some young children, church members. It's a it's just a very interesting way of finding things out. So it kind of underscored that the website was just really a well-received idea when it was brought up, but information would need to be given as an outreach campaign. It would need to be really consistent, the logo. These were all ideas from the parents themselves, that just basically every place they would go, they would see the same information so that they'd know and have like reassurance that this was the official place where they got information on programs from Utah. Their stigma does affect the willingness to seek services. Some of the stigma is just an internal not wanting to receive government services. There's also stigma with things like the WIC program. If someone at the checkout stand doesn't know how to do it, that can be embarrassing. People can make fun of you while you're standing there. So those were some of the things we found. And then we knew we'd find barriers by community and background, but it was really interesting, the differences, just like two rural areas that stood out, Price and Blanding. In Price, one of the participants noted that a lot of people don't have driver's licenses, which was a surprise, given I thought rural areas, there's a lot of discussion also of how they would have to go to different cities to receive different services. And so if you don't even have, not only just not a car, but not a driver's license, then you're dependent on someone else to get you to each of those services. Whereas in Blanding, everybody has a car, but everything's just so far away and there's no coverage, that those were very different. But they were similar in things like a lot of people in those areas had burner phones instead of a normal phone, and that meant that they'd sign up for a service, but by the time the service would send check in with them again, they would have changed their phone number and it was difficult to reach them and that kind of thing. Word of mouth is likely first contact. So these are, this is information, access, and quality, the three areas that were, and I don't know why this is looking so different, but I apologize. Word of mouth was the likely first contact. Families often receive their first childhood services after a birth or diagnosis. So people were kind of split on whether or not that was the best time. Birth was like when they have you, so it's perfect time in some cases, but others said, oh, I just was so overwhelmed, I didn't pay attention to any of the things I got then. So a lot of people looked at the well child checkups as the best time to try to reach people, and that isn't actually a consistent time when they're being reached by doctors. They liked the idea of one-stop website. They thought some people might need some help in navigating it, and that there would be security needed, just this notion that they'd be assured that this was the right place to go. They suggested flyers at doctor's offices, community fairs, local Facebook pages, radio, and billboards. And this next one is so small, but I wanted to just show that if you went to our website, we have the whole report, and just that one little dot, this was some of the examples of all of the ideas that they provided on how you might get information out to people. One example would be in Blanding, the Navajo Health System Health Fair turns out to be just a great place to get information out because everybody goes to that. So people who were at the table said they've been working in early childhood services forever, but they never met each other until they bumped into each other at that. Access, there were transportation problems dealing with transit, expense associated with cars in terms of both the car itself and insurance, lack of driver's licenses, long distances, were all an issue. And then English language learners really struggle with a lot of things. Paperwork, public transportation is difficult, websites. That was one of the feedbacks on the website is a translation certainly for Spanish, but for those other languages like Somali or even other tribal languages, something like Google Translator won't help. They'll need someone who can actually go through it with them because it's not always an exact science there with those types of programs. So anyway, that they do need help with that. And also, sadly, in-person caseworker assistance, people that don't speak English well were not treated well when they went in for programs. In terms of quality Head Start, we worked with three of them, and the people that are working with them were really pleased with how things were going for their kids. Difficulties included things like a school referral lag time and rude caseworker interactions. Parents wish they'd known about services for their older children. That was a common thing. If one of the younger kids had a diagnosis, then they received all this information about all these things they could have been receiving all along, but they just didn't know about it.
And then the website, everybody really supported the idea of the website. They were comfortable with a universal ID. They see it as being similar to a Medicaid ID or the one at the school, but they don't want it to be their social security number. They did have concerns about lacking a phone, a laptop or internet, and discomfort with the internet and also the language barriers. They were really committed to the idea of an official logo and pervasive and consistent marketing. And they have just this notion that once it's out there, to treat it, someone said, like a drug rep going to every doctor's office, like just get the information out there wherever you can so that people know about it. And then, I went too far. Okay. This last one is just some of the things that the leaders in the discussion roundtables mentioned early on, addressing geographic and technological limitations in rural areas and tribal lands. That was borne out with our groups. You're dealing with a lot of people who don't have money, don't have access to vehicles, or learn how to drive, so transportation is really hard, was for a prize participant. And don't lose the human focus. When I went to apply for Medicaid and food assistance, I was treated with such disrespect that I just left. I felt like I was begging for them for help, and it may have just been one button I forgot to push that made the difference. It was the way they acted, eye rolls and stuff like that. I wouldn't go back unless I was the last resort. I took the bus with 5 kids to meet them. That was hard. I just left. So I think it's really important to remember just how difficult things are that seem pretty basic, but even when some people are showing up at the right place and they know that they actually can receive this service, they're being treated in such a way that they're not able to access them. So this last one, in terms of keys to success, we were really pleased with the variety of people that we were able to hear from, and even more pleased that when all these people showed up, we were able to give the information to Ellison and the Sorensen Center so it could inform the needs assessment and the strategic plan, because it was a real honor to hear all of these voices, and it was an enjoyable project.
Great stuff. Thank you. Questions from board members? Thanks. We've given you a lot to digest today in a very short amount of time. We do have some time to digest that as we move forward. Karen, anything else
that you missed?
Okay. December 12th at 10 a.m. will be our next meeting. Anything else from the board members before we adjourn? I just want to thank you all for coming. Again, I want to thank all of our partners from all across the state that are here today. We hope you'll be able to join us again in December. We look forward to seeing you. With that, I will look for a motion to adjourn. And a second?
Second.
All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Stand adjourned. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Yes.
Can we have a moment?
Your colleague, Laura?
Yes. That was a good one as well. Let's go.
Jamie Dad.